30 years ago, there were no hashtags, no cable news shouting matches, no social media debates over something called Medicare for All. But there was one daughter, one mother, one heartbreaking experience inside another country's national healthcare system. When Beth Ashmore lost her mother while she was traveling in England, she sat down and wrote an extraordinary letter to then Oklahoma Senator David Borum. She wasn't trying to score political points. She was just trying to prevent another family from living through what hers had just endured. Today, as America once again debates expanding the federal government's role in healthcare, we're going back to that letter to ask what it got right, what's changed, and what every policymaker should understand before trying to redesign one of the most complicated systems in the world. Let's get briefed.
This is the Benefits Brief, the official podcast of the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals. Your fast track to what you need to know to stay sharp, informed, and ready to deliver for your clients. And now, here's your host, former NABIP president and award-winning podcaster, David Saltzman.
And our guest today is someone many Benefits Brief listeners already know. Beth Ashmore is a past president of NABIP, a longtime benefits professional, someone who has spent decades helping employers and families navigate healthcare, and of course, my dear friend. But today, we're not talking first about insurance. We're going to talk about Beth's mother, because before Beth became an advocate in Washington, she became an advocate for someone she loved. And that experience produced a remarkable letter that still resonates today. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be here.
Before we discuss healthcare policy, I think everyone needs to understand your mother. So tell us about your mom. Who was she? What kind of person was she before this trip?
Well, that's a dig deep question. She and my dad, just to kind of preface the generational issue, both of them were Depression babies and Dust Bowl babies. Dad lived in northern Oklahoma. Mom lived in Kansas, and it was just solid dirt, so they had absolutely nothing. And part of the group of people that would pile all of their belongings into a back of an open wagon and think that they're going to head west to California to better lands, and wound up turning around and coming back. So she grew up in a very hard knocks, have to dig it out the hard way environment. Consequently, she was stubborn a mule, tough. She had very high expectations of herself and high expectations for everybody around her, and she made that very clear with her students. She was an award-winning concert cellist, had been a cello professor at the University of Oklahoma for 30-plus years by the time she passed away. So she was very accomplished in her own way, and spent a lot of time nurturing students and stuff. So that was pretty much her whole life.
So what brought her to England? Why was she out there?
University of Oklahoma, and I assume that they still do this, they every summer would pile about 20 kids onto an airplane, and they would arrange concerts in various places in Europe. And so the orchestra members and band members would be chosen, and they would be part of a group that would go overseas and tour. And she, by the time we got her home, she had 20 crossings at the Atlantic. So she went every summer with a different group of kids. And it was quite an eye-opening experience for them, as well as an eye-opening experience for her. And because of all those times that she went overseas, she developed many friendships with other orchestra members and folks around various orchestras and stuff over there. Additionally, she was part of a university trio that also toured overseas. She actually played the Vatican with the Vienna Boys Choir. I mean, just incredible experiences all the way around. So she was in England with 20 kids, two or three other professors and stuff that were there, and they were in the process of touring England and parts of France.
So I remember from our original conversations all those years ago that her students just loved her. What do you think made her so special to her kids?
Even though she was tough, she was very open, and she was all in with those kids. You know, she was the kind of professor that you could call if you had boyfriend problems, if you had money problems, if you didn't have money for lunch. And that was the relationship she had, not only with her professor peers, but also with her kids. And she was able to recruit and bring on many, many, many merit scholars. And those, you know, college is quite a transition for anybody. You go from snuggles at home to, oh my God, I'm on my own. I got to make my own decisions. Shocker. And she was one of those professors that was just all in and was there for those life transitions.
So before we get into talking about healthcare, what do you hope listeners understand about your mom?
She, because of her stubbornness, she did not ask for help very often. And one of the things that became and continues to become very important as myself and my husband have aged into the point is understanding how you've got to be your own best advocate. Even in our system, with any system, you've got to be your own best advocate. And her generation, like many before, you never questioned doctors. She just didn't ask for help. And as articulate and strong as she was, how people related with their medical providers in those days and what the expectation of that relationship was very, very different than what we do now. And as patients, Will and I have to be very, very careful and ask. I mean, you've really got to advocate for your position. And we've heard many speakers at our conventions on this kind of situation. So that's one of the takeaways, obviously, amongst others that we'll discuss through this conversation.
So you know, every healthcare debate eventually becomes personal. Yours certainly did. Walk us through those final weeks. When did you first realize that something wasn't quite right?
I got a call from one of the other professors that was on the bus that mom was not doing well. And at first, I'm just thinking, you know, surely she would have called me and done something. But again, the stubbornness comes into play. Gee, I wonder, you're smiling. I'm thinking, you're thinking, oh, that apple didn't fall far from the tree.
I said nothing.
So that really came into play with the lack of her taking hold of where she really was. And he had mentioned she was not doing well. So I called all kinds of airlines, made arrangements to have her tickets switched and fly her directly to Oklahoma City from Heathrow in London and get her home early. She wouldn't do it. She just didn't think she was that sick. I know, I get it. I walked on a broken leg for 5 days before it was x-rayed. I've done it. So you're right. The apple didn't fall far from the tree.
So when did you realize that the physicians out there were looking at the situation differently than you did?
Man, real quickly, very, very quickly. The tone of voice, the lack of what they were telling me, when that in the last 3 week period, I made an attempt to get her home. She refused to do that. That was about 2 weeks prior to her death. And she had a friend there in London that she had made many years ago. And so she just wanted to get to Margaret's house at the end of the tour. She was just going to stay there and stay with Margaret. Well, that occurred. Margaret calls and says, your mom's not doing well. I'm taking her to the hospital. Now, I am gathering that the facility that they went to, because she lived on the northern edges of London, was more like what we would call today as an urgent care center. And a couple of days later, they treated her a little bit. And then a couple of days later, she's not doing any better. And I get a call and the doctors say, she has lumps in her tummy. That was a diagnosis. So I said, can we do a biopsy? No, we don't do biopsies here. And the whole tone of their voice and the lack of care and the pragmatic approach to your health at certain ages was just incomprehensible. We have a real attitude in this country of no holds barred, which is great, but it can be very expensive. And that's, you know, that's part of our debate down the road. But I made such a stink out of it. And by the time, before, when she was in her 40s, she had a freestanding non-malignant tumor in her abdomen. So I knew there was a possibility they were not malignant. And just because they were lumps, the doctors were convinced it was cancer. no biopsy, but they're convinced it was cancer. So I turn around and I get Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oklahoma, who insured the benefits at OU. I get them on the phone. They approve in 6 hours a $56,000 jet that will go from Atlanta to Heathrow to pick her up and bring her home. That jet now would probably be $256,000. But Blue Cross just absolutely did a phenomenal job. I got David Bourne's office on the phone. They connected me to the American Embassy in London. And I had all those connections done immediately. And I had a plan to get her out of there. And they were going to medevac her to Dallas. Jet her to Dallas, medevac her to the roof of Oklahoma City Baptist Hospital with a kidney team on call. So her doctors bought into it, Blue Cross bought into it, Bourne's office bought into it, the embassy bought into it. I get a call from the doctors reaming me because I was trying to move her. You just need to put her, we'll just put her on morphine and put her in the back of the ward and let her stay comfortable. That's when you know you're really in trouble. Doctors here, while they're busy and overloaded and all kinds of things, they act like they care. They really want to cure the patient. They want to help the patient. And that whole scenario and the whole vibe and approach and lack of push was just tremendously overwhelming. But I had a plan. I was pissed. We had everybody in line to do it, and it was going to work. Unbeknownst to me, they moved Mother because of the pressure from the embassy, I think, in hindsight, to another facility. I get a call before they moved her that, actually it was after they moved her. It was such a blur. I get a call at 3 o'clock in the morning from the doctor saying, we don't do dialysis because she's over 50.
Whoa. Say that again?
They will not do dialysis on individuals over 50 years of age. Now, okay. If you go to a dialysis center in anywhere in any state, it's packed mostly with people over 50. And the system is so pragmatic about what they're going to offer and what they do at certain ages and expectations of improved lifespan after that procedure that you can't get it. Well, then I'm really pissed. Excuse my language. So that's when we really activated the issue with the jet and the whole nine yards. Unbeknownst to me, they had moved Mom to another facility. I didn't realize it, but the protocol, because it's considered a repatriation, Mom had no clothes on. Her friend Margaret had her passport, her ID, all her belongings and everything. Margaret has them at her house. So the American Embassy got a temporary passport issued in a matter of few hours so that they could try to get her out of there. The protocol for the jet companies or anybody bringing a patient back into this country is they need to call and confirm the patient's going to survive the trip home, which makes sense. I just didn't know that. And I didn't realize it until the next day. I'm thinking the jet's already taken off. They've got her. They're probably on their way back. So the next day I call just to get a status with the jet company.
So let's take a pause for a second. I want to kind of go backwards and then we'll pick up the jet when we get done. When you were amazingly told that dialysis generally wasn't performed on patients over a certain age, looking backwards and with all the experiences that have happened since then, what did that teach you about rationing healthcare in this kind of a Medicare for all NIS type system?
Budget begets limits. And when you have medical coverage determined by the federal government, there are and will be limits. Right now, we have an open spigot, and the cost, the GDP cost on our healthcare goes up every single year. But when you have a social system, they're clouding it in this Medicare for all. Because everybody thinks Medicare is so great, it'll just pay for everything. And you get a Medicare supplement and yada, 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 and we'll go down the road. Kumbaya. Because then the federal budgets are going to come in and say, we're going to determine what's going to be reasonable. Part of, I know this is a little bit of a sidebar, but it's part of that learning piece. One of the things that was included in ACA was PCORI, Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. That is exactly, in my mind, and even at the time, that's exactly how I interpreted it, is going to have research on outcomes on certain procedures at certain age. This is already in the law. So if you do go ahead, David.
How should scarce resources be allocated? Should the government make those decisions? Should insurers?
The government should not be making those decisions. And the irony in our current system is they do make a lot of decisions. Medicare and CMS drives a lot. All network arrangements and reimbursements are based on Medicare reimbursements. Medicare supplement plans will only pay what Medicare pays. Anything else, you know, you get to pay, maybe. And yes, we have some real issues to deal with on the scarcity of resources. There is absolutely no doubt. It's going to be some tough discussions. We've got rural healthcare issues we've got to deal with. We've got aging population that's going to be dealing with. Us boomers are killing the budget. We know that. So it's going to be a hard conversation, but it's got to happen. And if you've been tracking all of this fraud that they're coming up in these systems, we could pay for so much if we just clean up our act.
That's true. That's true. So let's go back to, okay, you had the jet on standby. Blue Cross of Oklahoma said, okay, we're going to send it. What happened when you followed up?
When I followed up, I was told that the jet never left the ground. They couldn't find her. Now, answer me this. What even a teeny tiny hospital in this country would not have a record, line disclosures, authorizations from providers, et cetera, and who received the patient and not have a record of where they went. But they could not find the patient in order to confirm her condition and confirm that she could make it home.
Was that part of the bureaucracy inherent in that NIS system over there?
Yes.
Well, I mean, I know you have always been a very forceful person. I mean, even the badgering that you gave them, they were immune to. Nothing moved the needle?
Nothing moved the needle. And what was ironic, what needle did move, as far as even moving her to a better facility, was because she was not a British citizen. She shouldn't have been treated this way in the first place. She's an American citizen. So anytime anybody travels to Europe, you better be prepared for something very different than what we have here.
And yet, today's Medicare for All advocates argue that healthcare is a universal right. So when you hear that phrase, what's your first reaction, given what you've gone through with your mom? And then we'll pick up her story after this.
Last I checked, we had three rights in the Constitution. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Everything else you got to work your butt off to get. And I don't think healthcare and, quite honestly, even Social Security and all these other cushy things that we've gotten used to, they're not a right. They were legislated and they were put in there, but they are not constitutionally a right.
So do you just then say, okay, the heck with everybody? If you can afford it, you buy it. And if you can't afford it, there are other programs for you?
I do think that there are reasonable needs, obviously, for Medicaid, Medicare, et cetera. But we've got to stop the runaway train. We've got to be very clear about what pays for what. And the irony in these most recent laws and passed and what's changed with the PDP cards and all this other stuff lately and changing the out-of-pocket from $8,000 to $2,000, and then everybody's blown away because their premiums have quadrupled. You know, it's a balloon. You squeeze it one end, it's going to come out the other end.
Well, that's true. So,
and that's the part that legislators don't get. If they do get it, they don't go public with it. In a pure sense, everything is driven now in this crazy, crazy environment we've got of how we're going to package it or market it so that we can sell it, whether it's worthwhile or the right thing to do or not.
You're right about that. So let's go back to the plane never got off the ground. What happened then?
She was just put in the back of the ward, put on morphine, and she passed away a day later.
Oh, my word.
And then it took me 3 weeks to get her home. And from what I understood from many people, that 3 weeks was short. It's usually a couple months to get people home after they pass away overseas. And it was because I had the relationship established with her senator's office and the American embassy that allowed me to get that pulled off in 3 weeks. Her belongings came a good month later, and the belongings had to go through customs, and she had to go through customs. The casket had to go through customs.
That's interesting.
I can halfway, at the time I didn't understand it, made me furious. But with all of the drug issues and things going on and the things people try to pull, I can understand it in today's environment. But I sure was taken aback by all that.
When folks talk about, let's back up a little bit. So beyond the things that happened with your mom, which were all pretty dang horrible, what do Americans today misunderstand about what national healthcare systems are? I mean, we hear about Canada and the waits up there and whatnot. What do they know? Obviously, you've, since your mom's passing, I know you followed this very closely, every place it exists. What don't people really understand?
Okay, there's several things they don't understand. First of all, cost causes limits. There will be limits. Number two, we spent a tremendous amount of time, ledge teams did, during the HillaryCare fight and Obamacare fight, putting together tremendous comparisons on statistics by country versus the U.S. And I love, one of my favorite quotes of the whole world is Will Rogers, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. And they would try to match statistics from one country to another, but each country puts different things in their statistics. So you're not comparing apples to apples in any way, shape, or form. So knowing what's included in those stats, understanding the outcomes, understanding our expectations, understanding that there are going to be some limits, and mainly the main thing, I think, at this point, is everybody tried to fix the healthcare system by fixing health insurance, and that's not going to work. Health insurance is just the financer.
Economists talk a lot about balancing. They think the challenge is balancing cost, access, and quality. What do you see that as?
As far as the big challenge?
Yeah, I mean they say, well, you know, it can't be a one or the other or the third thing. It's got to be. I mean, economists, you know, are people who, if you put them all end to end, they still wouldn't reach a conclusion. But that's kind of their viewpoint on this. Do you think it's a balance issue? Or how would you approach it?
It is a balance issue. And you've got to be very reasonable. You've got to be caring. You've got to understand that there is a demographic that we've got to address. You've got to understand rural health care, their access. We've got clients that live in teeny tiny towns where there's no hospital. We've also got to understand that regulating insurance the way they have done it has done nothing but drive cost, because insurance is evaluation of risk. And ACA completely eliminated the carrier's ability to evaluate risk, right? Everything's guaranteed issue. Now, was it a moral thing to do? Probably yes. Was it an incredibly expensive thing to do? Absolutely it was.
And yet Americans sometimes debate healthcare as though, because we're Americans, we can have everything simultaneously.
Right. No, there's going to be some trade-offs. Your own personal budget, you've got trade-offs.
So which trade-offs aren't discussed honestly? And what should policymakers just finally admit if they're going to have an honest conversation about this?
Well, they need to admit that there's going to be limits if Medicare for All goes into place. Number one. Number two, Medicare is on a financial downturn, as well as Social Security. Where are they going to get the money? It's going to be a number one taxpayer. There is nothing free. And I don't know that in my lifetime I will ever hear an elected official say there's nothing free.
It's It's not something you generally hear. Certainly not off the hill. Let's go back to your letter. One thing that just jumps off the page of your letter, and every piece of it, is advocacy. What should you look for in the benefits experience that helps us know which buttons to push? How important was that knowledge that you had?
Oh my gosh, it was huge. By the time this happened, I had spent two years on National Ledge Council and 3 years on state ledge team. And knowing what elected officials, what your state senator or national senator's office can do, and the connections with embassies, and understanding what other countries do, and the importance, because my job for the first probably 5 years, I was called the grassroots chairman, and my job was key contacts across the country. And during Hillary Care, when we had no chapters in Vermont, I don't know that we had chapters in New Hampshire. I would call a mechanic, I would call Life Guy, and say, "Here's your message. Here's what I want you to say, and who to say it to." I didn't care what they were. But getting the message clear, succinct, and well-balanced, not snarky, just articulated and detailed homework.
For so families, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Like the consultant that you are.
Well, and that's the question. You know, for families without an advocate, does that make benefit advisors even more valuable today?
Huge. They're absolutely more important today than they were. I've been at this 47 years. I sold $28 employee rates my first year in the business. We didn't have to know anything. I got a rate book and an outline of benefits and said, "Go get them," and a phone book.
I remember those days.
Yes. Yes.
Fondly, it was, "Do you want the $100 deductible or the $250 deductible?" And they were all indemnity plans.
Correct. Absolutely correct. No networks until the 80s or so. And look at the laws that have been passed in the last 40 years alone. And every single piece of legislation had...
Yeah, they all do.
Got to understand layer after layer after layer of that. And then the icing on the cake was ACA. It is going to change the dynamics of insurance in general. And they think that they're doing everybody a favor by fixing healthcare, by fixing insurance. Didn't come close.
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember a lot of us were on the road during Clinton Care and arguing and educating members and other folks. But let's go back to your letter for a second, because it wasn't just about your mom. It was a warning. So 30 years later, which parts of that letter have aged remarkably well?
Pretty much all of it. Just to be blunt, in my mind, and I listen to the news and I'm thinking, oh my God, here we go again. And I am more concerned about our position now than I even was with Hillary and Obama. We've got a generation or two, and that's why I thank you for this opportunity to share this message again. We've got members and folks that are out there that are nice and young. That haven't lived through any of this fight before and don't quite understand that this free pitch that they're getting is a hoax. Because nothing is free. Either the taxpayers are going to pay it or they're going to limit benefits. That's one of your two choices. And somebody somewhere has got to call it the way it is. That's the warning. And it worries me not only about our industry and about our healthcare, because you and I are at that generation that if they start cutting benefits, we're going to be the first ones to be hit. The 30-somethings will hit it later on, but it's coming.
Yeah, as our friend Donna used to say, it's happiness and it's heading your way.
Correct. That's absolutely correct.
Let's end as we wrap up where we begin, not with politics, but with people. So two questions. First, if every member of Congress were listening today, what would you want them to remember before voting on healthcare?
Just remember, you're dealing with people's lives. And I mean, literally, you're dealing with people's lives. And the minute we go to a system where it's Medicare for all, there's going to be limits. There will be challenges with pulling back on 5 weeks after I lost Mom, my dad had bypass surgery. He was 83. There was no question. That kind of thing would start pulling back and pulling back and pulling back as costs keep going up.
And your mother was how old when they told her they wouldn't do dialysis?
70.
Yeah.
So that's she was 20 years too old.
Stark contrast between that and the surgery for your dad.
Absolute huge contrast.
If you were going to address NABIP members and folks who maybe you're thinking about joining or folks who've wandered away from the flock, so to speak, what would your message be to them?
Suit up. Every single member, every single individual, every single leader is a constituent. Study, get the facts, learn how to deliver those facts in an impartial way. Get in front of your elected officials. Every single one of you cast a vote, I hope, and suit up. Couple of other quick messages. I've heard members or potential members express concerns about joining because they'd be around competitors. And one of the most special things that happened during that wild time with Mom, a competitor who turned out to be a lifelong, very, very good friend, had a business associate. I had received a call from the American Embassy saying that they needed $3,000 in order to embalm Mother to even get her ready for a flight. I didn't have $3,000 at the time. And this friend's business partner, because of the relationships that were done at the time through NAHU, offered to go to the embassy. He was there at Lloyd's of London, and he said, I'll go to the embassy and put $3,000 down. That's what you get by being a member. It's not just the advocacy piece. Suit up, you might learn something. And most importantly, you will gain mentorship and lifelong friendships that will never go away, that change your career direction and change your complete outcome and perspective on things because you hear so many different opinions and things. Your ability to deliver that message is all done because you're around people like you, David, and Shirley and others in the past, that if you fumbled up, you'd get thumped and say, you need to do it this way.
We did a pretty good job thumping. All of us thumped each other when we needed it, and that was part of the plus. Yeah, it's part of what you get when you buy in. You get the NAHU family. The only thing that saves us is that I think we're not all crazy on the same day.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there are plenty of white papers about healthcare, thousands of statistics, and endless political speeches, but sometimes one family's story teaches us more than all of them. Beth, thanks for sharing your mom's story, the remarkable letter you wrote more than 30 years ago, and for helping us explore the difficult questions that still surround healthcare reform today. I'm David Saltzman, and until next time, you've been briefed.
Stay ahead with the Benefits Brief. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or catch every episode in your member-exclusive Washington Update each Friday. To learn more about how NABIP helps you succeed, or to become a member, visit NABIP.org. That's NABIP.org.